Arts and music, music and arts. Just two of American society parts. Not much good unless all the others make us feel like sisters and brothers. Hey, happy Earth Day, everybody, if you're listening on Thursday. A big week in America's history. Fingers crossed that the steps forward are not followed by equal amounts in the opposite direction. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross, the man behind the microphone, transmitting news and views of the arts, culture, and humanities found plentifully here in western Wisconsin. This week, as National Poetry Month continues, the unflinching poetic onions of Bruce Taylor will help celebrate 35 years leading the regional ranks of Wisconsin Public Radio in a chat with Dean Kallenbach, now retired from the daily grind. Jim Oliver jumps back in the Spectrum pool to splash around for old time's sake. He welcomes author Patricia Skalka with another Door County mystery. And we begin with the special 2021 Eau Claire Jazz Festival, another example of ingenuity trouncing obstruction, determined people helping music replace any potential for grumbling. Tomorrow night, Friday, April 23rd, the 55th Eau Claire Jazz Festival presents A Night with Local Legends, four talented guest musicians who would have respectively disputed the Legends label, but they didn't have time because they had music to make. Just so we can feel like abnormal times are diminishing. Robert Baca is the father, grandfather, uncle, and proud busker of the Jazz Festival, so we talked about the concert, recorded so recently that the instruments are still warm.
We taped on April 17th on Saturday. We recorded all day. It's interesting with the different protocols. When your audience does see the concert, our students will have masks on, and a huge consideration for us and the way that we've been functioning in the music school throughout the whole year is we have bell covers because aerosol is a very high concern. So you'll see us with bell covers, and the rim is not able to be performed in more than a half hour at a time.
I'm talking with you on a very busy day. You have interviews, you have rehearsals, and you were kind enough to make room for me, so I appreciate it. Give our audience a taste of what a typical, and I was going to say day, but I don't think you could do that, but in Robert Baca's life, like the week before the Jazz Festival.
Well, let's put it this way. Since I've been here for so many years, I kiss my wife goodbye, and then I see her in a couple of weeks. I actually am home, and I have been home more often than I usually am. But yes, I mean, the Jazz Festival is a very big deal, not just in Eau Claire, but known throughout the United States and internationally as well. It's so much fun, though, and the students are all on the entire journey. Mm-hmm. So it's rehearsals, it's the publicity things that are going on. We have a huge force of people within Eau Claire Jazz Incorporated with interns, and the whole board is involved, faculty and administrators from the university. And it's very much just like a wedding, doing all the planning. We're in high expectation of what we're doing. We're having fun. But when the day actually comes, it's like celebrating a wedding.
Wonderful. There's a video that I watched with Bob Baca for about 3 minutes and some odd seconds in which you start with the phrase, "With great tragedy comes great innovation." And and basically that is what this jazz festival is all about. Let's set the stage. Sean Carey, S. Carey, Bon Iver, Sue Orfield, the Sue Orfield Band, the Tiptons, Acousta Who. Tell us more about Jeremy Betcher.
People don't know Jeremy Betcher as much, but he's probably one of America's greatest sidemen. He doesn't have any albums out himself, but primarily these days, he is doing things with Lincoln Center, New York. Lincoln Center is expanding their Dizzy's Coca-Cola Jazz Clubs. So he travels with a trio led by pianist Richard Johnson, who played with Wynton Marsalis in the late 1990s and early 2000s, and then was a pianist for the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra in New York City for many, many years. Richard was tired of New York, so he bought an apartment in Minneapolis wanted to just get out of New York for 2 to 3 days a week. And he met another of our UW-Eau Claire alumni, Adrian Suarez, a drummer, and they have been a trio ever since.
And the name Josh Gallagher is a name that comes up almost every time someone in Western Wisconsin says, "We need a piano player." You know?
Josh Gallagher is a genius. It reminds me of the way people talk about Jeffrey Keyser. Mm-hmm. Audiences love the musicians that Jeffrey Keyser plays with, and all of the musicians are in awe of Jeffrey Keyser.
Yeah.
Just on another level.
And all of these wonderful guests backed by the Grammy-nominated Jazz Ensemble One. Very good stuff. We're on the phone with Robert Baca, and we're talking about A Night of Local Legends, the 2021 version of the Eau Claire Jazz Festival. Of course, under the circumstances of COVID and pandemic, at least one more year, we're going to be careful. And this is a virtual affair. Friday night, tomorrow night, if you're listening, Thursday, April 23rd, begins at 7:30. Guest musician are Sean Carey, Sue Orfield, Jeremy Betcher, and Josh Gallagher. Now, Bob, I can imagine these four individuals doing their individual things in front of Jazz One, but I couldn't help but to imagine them being on stage together for a big ending. Should I imagine that? I mean, as like a power quartet.
Let me just say that jazz is a very improvisatory art form.
Yes, it is. That's all I need to hear. Yes, I appreciate that. You talked about how well-known and legendary the Eau Claire Jazz Festival is. Interestingly enough, being virtual and, again, making lemonade out of lemons and great innovation,
right. It
has the potential now of having a worldwide audience. That can't hurt recruiting.
This has been an unprecedented time, and we figured out how to do technology because we had to. Teachers all across the nation have gone through this where they are more technologically savvy for every age group because it's something that we have to do. That's the great tragedy comes great innovation.
Yeah.
And part of that is we've been able to reach people with music all over the world, thanks to Zoom and some of the other formats. And as a matter of fact, for this year, we do have some international components for the Jazz Festival. We have a wonderful professional jazz ensemble, the Taipei, Taiwan Jazz Orchestra, and they're going to do a concert on Thursday night.
Cool.
So that will be Thursday night at 7 o'clock. And that's actually led by a former alumni of ours, and the story is just the greatest. Taiwan, of course, put stringent orders down right away when COVID hit. Their country experienced very little. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure that they locked down even one time. And according to what Jim was saying, because they were one of the only open markets for musicians in the world, even from China, that musicians who were playing with the greatest musicians around the world, you know, are not doing it now. They were moving to Taiwan from Asia and from America. It just became known that this is where there's work because they're not shut down. So he said these incredible musicians moved there, and he took total advantage of it and formed this ensemble.
Cool.
And that's going to be part of our jazz festival, and then he'll be opening that all up and our concert Friday to an Asian audience as well.
Okay. How can we watch the Thursday event?
I would just go to the webpage and all the instructions will be there.
That's cool. Okay. And you were talking about the fact that, you know, you innovated and you have adjusted simply because you had to. But it's interesting to note the fact that you have had to respond and innovate has to mean very good things for future festivals. It's going to seem easy, first of all. And secondly, you will want to innovate because you've seen what innovation can do for you. So it's good for the whole creative juices.
Exactly. Our mentality is on a whole different level. We've learned about something that we just never experienced before, and we are totally going to take advantage of it for next year as well. We will continue to be an international jazz festival as well as one that's in person.
Well, I got my ticket.
Good.
And anybody who wants to can go online. You can go to eauclairejazz.com. There's a link to the Pablo Center ticket booth, and that's where you can do the purchase, and it's very easy and very seamless. One final question, Bob. How far ahead are you looking? Are you guys noodling 2022 ideas already?
We absolutely are. We've already looked at our artists that have put feelers out, and, you know, I was watching a film the other day, and it reminded me a little bit of our festival. Just a couple of years ago, the movie King of Jazz, which was all about Paul Whiteman, who was the most influential white jazz figure in the 1920s. And basically, he was a showman. Vaudeville was big, and Broadway shows were just coming about. And if you ever watch this show, it was just colorized, and so it's crystal clear now. And the show starts with something that could be an ender, and then for an hour and a half, it just goes from there. And that's kind of the way I look at our jazz festival for next year. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to get started on it.
I had Jeffrey Keyser on and Jillian Margot a couple weeks ago.
Oh, nice.
Talking about his Pablo Streams concert. We talked about the joy of jazz, and I was making fun of myself because I said, you know, when I watch jazz, what I find fascinating with jazz is it's almost as enjoyable to watch jazz musicians play as it is to listen to them play, because I love to watch how involved they get, and you can just see it on their faces. He said, man, we are very goofy looking when we play. He said, you'll see me smile a lot, and, you know, everybody looks at each other. And it happens especially with people you don't play with very often. It's all these pleasant surprises that pop up.
Right. It's like playing a game, and the audience is there getting some of it, but learning a lot more about it, like you say, through the expressions of the musicians and getting inside their minds and watching what they're smiling about and saying, what was that?
Robert Baca, thanks. Get back to work. I know you have lots to do, and I appreciate you being with us. Best of luck on this year's festival. You don't need it. Man, we're looking forward to the 2022 version because I have a feeling it's going to be huge and innovative and fun. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Al. Bye-bye.
And the place to go, of course, to participate is eauclairejazz.com. Okay? Okay. Got a little bit of UW Eau Claire Jazz Ensemble 1 from the archives. This is back there. This is from 2010, believe it or not. Coming up, poetry, Bruce Taylor style. Dean Kallenbach's style was never described as retiring until now. And Jim Oliver next. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio, where support comes from Trust Point in Eau Claire, dedicated to offering impartial, objective, fiduciary investment management, financial planning, and retirement spending strategies since 1913. TrustPointInc.com. Support also comes from Wasco Windows, providing high-performance windows and doors engineered for Wisconsin's climate. Wasco is open during this crisis and able to provide quotes. More information is at wascowindows.com. Jim Oliver has said that he will drop in now and again, and for that we're thankful. This is one of those fortunate visits, a natural, because he's spoken with this Wisconsin author on every other occasion of yet another series chapter.
Patricia Skalka is the author of Death Stalks Door County, Death at Gill's Rock, Death in Cold Water, Death Rides the Ferry, and Death by the Bay. Those are the first five books in the Dave Kubiak Door County Mystery Series. The latest book in the series, Death Washes Ashore, released April 20th by the University of Wisconsin Press. Patricia Skalka joins us to talk about her book and whatever else we can get her to talk about. She's talking to us from her home in Milwaukee. Now, I remember talking with you a few years ago when you said you had written Deathstalks Door County as a standalone book. Later, that grew into a potential of 6, which obviously it has. So what's going to happen if your publisher wants some more?
Well, I'm actually working on book 7 right now.
Are you really?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have an idea what that's going to be about?
Well, it's moving along nicely. I don't like to talk about books in progress. It's like letting the cat out of the bag and then you can't get it back
yet. Then you can't get it, yeah, right. And you may change your mind.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, tell us about your books for those who may not have read the first 5 stories.
You know, I did start it intending to do what's called a one and done because I couldn't imagine writing a series. It sounded totally overwhelming. And it was as I was working on the first book, Deathstalks Door County, that other ideas started coming to me. So by the time I finished the first one, I already knew what the second one was going to be, and I thought I would do 4, like there would be 1 a season. By the time I had 4 written, I already knew what 5 was going to be and 6 was going to be. So it just kind of went on from there. But the idea behind it is each book is really a standalone. It can be read as its own mystery. You don't have to read all of them. Mm-hmm. But the stories taken together take the protagonist, Dave Kubiak, and his close cadre of friends and colleagues through time. So they all get older and face new issues, and life goes on. So if you read them from the beginning on through, you get this sense of tracking what's happening to them in their lives. And the reason I wanted to do that, I really burdened Kubiak with intense guilt and grief in book 1. He's a former Chicago homicide detective. He drinks himself out of his job after his wife and daughter are killed. He feels responsible for their deaths. He comes to Door County to literally escape life and escape himself. But he doesn't like it there. He wants to leave. You know, that's part of the first book. Of course, he ends up staying. And I realized if I was going to write a series, I had to help this man. I couldn't just leave him in that place of all of this pain. And the only way I could figure out how to do that was to move the stories through time. So he would grow older, circumstances would change, and he would eventually become kind of a different person, really. He would learn to accept himself. He would learn to reconnect with life. So while each of the books has its own what writers call a story arc, which is essentially a beginning, a middle, and end, like a 3-act play, the series has an overall story arc, and that is Kubiak's personal journey, redeeming himself from his past and learning to reconnect with life, learning to trust people. So that's kind of the background of the whole package.
Okay, well, let's talk about Death Washes Ashore. While you're doing that, you can explain to us what LARPers are.
Oh, you know, each book comes from a different place. Each one has a different source of inspiration. Death Washes Ashore, I was talking to my daughter. I have 2 daughters, so I was talking to one of them, and she mentioned LARPing. Now, I had heard the the Revolutionary War reenactments, mm-hmm. and LARPing is like that. It's called live action role playing. People come up with concepts or ideas, and they put on costumes. You know, they could be a fantasy story. It could be a medieval knight story, you know, slaying the dragon. It can be anything you want. It can be like dashing off into outer space and settling Mars. But you have a group of people who agree to act out a story. And sometimes they do it just extemporaneously, and sometimes they actually follow scripts. They're called LARPers, live action role players. And listening to all of this, I thought, that's really cool. And I knew a little bit about the Revolutionary War reenactment. I had visited one of the locations and seen the people in costume and had a sense of what was involved. And then when I heard about this other one, and I was thinking about so many of them focus on medieval times, and then the notion of Door County becoming, you know, like having a place on it called Door Camelot. And I was kind of sold on the idea then of making that part of the story. At the same time, one of my neighbors up in Door County told me there had been a huge storm and a boat had washed up on a shore. And he kind of facetiously said, wouldn't it be kind of ironic if there had been a body under it? And we both kind of chuckled over that. And I said, oh, yeah, right, sure, that's not going to work for me. But the more I thought about it, I thought, what a great idea. So that's how these 2 very different situations came together to give me the basic plot concept for Death Washes Ashore, because, of course, it starts with a body found under a boat on the beach.
Mm-hmm. We are talking to Patricia Skalka, author of Death Washes Ashore. Well, the LARPers actually turned out to be a fairly significant part of the story, as I recall. There was a neighboring farmer who was mad at them, and there were lots of potential of people who were involved in the death. Can you dance around that a little bit without giving too much away?
Well, one of the things about writing a mystery is you always want to have a good sprinkling of suspects. Mm-hmm. So if you have a core group of people who are kind of like the team in this LARPers organization at Door Camelot, you very naturally have candidates to be suspects, and what you have to do is kind of give them background enough. Not all of them, but, you know, one or two is fine. You know, a discarded lover, someone who's got a grudge because of something that happened in the past the victim is involved in. And then, you know, the farmer, you mentioned the next door neighbor who's really furious because these people make a lot of noise when they're shooting off fake cannons and, you know, whooping around, and his cows are disturbed and he doesn't like it. And he's confronted them any number of times. You've got another candidate. And then I bring in a story of something that happened to someone else way back when, because I like to connect the past to the current crime. And you have suddenly another candidate. I think you come up with about like four or five likely suspects. And Kubiak's job is to recognize who all these people are, figure it out, what their motives are, and then pin one to the crime or eliminate them one by one. And there's a lot of twists and turns. And of course, the story may or may not end up where the reader thinks it will, but eventually he will find the person who's responsible for the murder.
Mm-hmm. Well, moving on to your past a little bit, you had had a successful career in nonfiction before you started writing mysteries. Do you do any nonfiction, or are you just strictly a fiction writer now?
I'm strictly fiction right now, but everything that I did as a nonfiction writer has helped me. I was a staff writer for the Reader's Digest for 20 years. I did a lot of medically related stories. I did human interest stories. I had to talk to people all the time, get them to tell me their stories, get them to pull out the emotions of what happened, or dig out information, research medical advances, and talk to the people who were responsible for them. So I use that in writing the fiction. Every book that I've written, I always try to kind of focus it in an area that I don't know anything about. You know, people say only write what you know. Well, that wouldn't be very interesting. You know, I feel like you should write what you're willing to learn about. I mean, I had to talk to people about LARPing and learn about that. There's a fire involved. I had to talk to the fire chief and ask questions. So you just learn how to gather the information that you need. I've done that in each of the books. In Death in Cold Water, I interviewed the FBI. Death at Gill's Rock, it was the head of the Coast Guard station in Sturgeon Bay. There's always some expert or group of experts I need to reach out to because they know what I need to know in order to write my story.
I always like to ask authors how you go about writing a book. When do you do your writing? Do it first thing in the morning, or do you do it late at night, or get up at 3 o'clock in the morning?
If I do it at 3 o'clock in the morning, I would be asleep at my desk. I can't write in the evening because then my mind is just going and going and going, and then I'll never fall asleep, and I'm still writing. I tend to write first thing in the morning. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if there are other things that I have to get to, then I'll save my time for later in the afternoon. What I really need is a block of time, 3 or 4 hours, to sit down and really just focus on it. And that's very draining. You know, at the end of 4 hours, that's about it. 5 hours, you know, that's absolute tops for this kind of work. You're creating a different world, and you have to step into it every time you sit down, and it has to be real in your own mind so that you can make it real on the page. I envy people who can, like, go to coffee shops and write. That does not work for me. I would probably work best in a cave. I need silence and just no distractions so I can live in this other world. In fact, it's probably one of the things that helped keep me sane this past year during this whole COVID pandemic, because I got to escape to my own little world.
Oh, yeah. You were fortunate in that angle of it.
I know.
Well, the book is Death Washes Ashore. It's the sixth in the series of the Dave Kubiak mystery novels. And we've been talking to the author, Patricia Skalka. Patricia, thanks for being with us, putting up with me, and best wishes on the book.
Thank you, and it's always a pleasure, Jim.
And always a pleasure to have y'all on the show there, Mr. Oliver. Thanks. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Don't forget the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild sponsoring a free playwriting workshop with playwrights Jim and Jane Jeffries to learn about building characters, dialogue, and plot lines, how to engage an audience, how to successfully end your play. The workshop, 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. on Saturdays, beginning this Saturday, the 24th, and May 22nd. If you're interested, email cvtgact@aol.com. They'll send you a Zoom link. Your own. And remember, Cultural Fest, formerly the International Folk Fair, is an annual UW Eau Claire event. The virtual event runs through tomorrow, Friday, April 23rd. Details at the Center for International Education. Hey, you know, who doesn't enjoy a retirement party? I mean, they're almost always a win-win. You're either genuinely delighted for the respected team member who now gets to enjoy life, or you're just plain happy to see him go. Well, this instance is the former. Dean Kallenbach recently called it a career after 35 years as the backbone of WPR's presence in West Wisconsin. I'm allowed to dance with you each week. Clara Neipert has new opportunities on the West Side, the times we've been able to connect at auctions and listener dinners and occasions when WPR brought the big guns to our part of Wisconsin, all thanks in large measure to the persistence and vision of Dean Kallenbach, who has fought to be sure that voices of the regions continue to blend with those in Madison, forming the choir that is Wisconsin Public Radio. So, hey, retired, what revelations have you had?
I have not yet run out of things to do.
No?
No. Mostly writing down things to do.
How are you sleeping?
Yeah, fine. I've always gone to bed late, even when I was working the 4:30 a.m. shift, just because I like being up late. I don't know why.
That explains your orneriness over those years.
Yeah.
You haven't had the dreams kick in yet. I hear that retirement causes dreams that are not inadequacy dreams, but of the something's missing dream, maybe.
I had a work-related dream a couple nights ago, and I woke up, and it's like, oh, yeah, I don't have to worry about that anymore. So that's... It was a little stressful while I was dreaming it, but then when I woke up, it was like, oh, cool.
You and I talked the other day about what you were thinking on the last day in the office.
Mm-hmm.
You admitted the situation that we've had over the last year, the pandemic, and people have been seldom face-to-face anyway, sort of lessened the melancholy.
Yeah. In the past year, the folks who would normally be in this office in Western Wisconsin have seldom been in the same place at the same time. Once in a while, a chance encounter as we're passing each other in the building. But you and I have only been coming in essentially to record, and we've pretty much been the only people coming in on a regular basis. Otherwise, people working from home and hopefully easing away from that soon, but I won't be part of that.
No.
So in a way, that camaraderie thing, we've found ways to stay connected, and we've talked to one another, and that's fine. But the sort of accidental conversation, you know, as you're standing in the lobby, that's just not happening, and that's a little sad, but it also probably makes it a little easier to go and know that I'm not missing some water cooler conversation.
After you made the decision to retire, how long ago did you decide?
I let the boss know in November. My position is called Senior Regional Manager. I'm the regional manager for Western Wisconsin, but I also supervise the other regions in the state. It's a position that I was the first to take back in 2005, and so I've been in it for 16 years. 16 years, you should be reevaluating that, and so that's what they did. Lisa Nalbandian, who was our Milwaukee regional manager, is currently the interim senior regional manager, and she's been talking to people and conducting surveys. I know she surveyed you, trying to find out, you know, what do we need? What do we need in the regional offices and what needs to happen? And she'll be very thoughtful about that and make some recommendations to senior management. I know that Mike Crane, the director of Wisconsin Public Radio, really values the regional offices. You know, when I started, there were 4 regional employees of WPR. There are now 30. You know, it's critical that we have people in the communities and in the regions that we serve.
Maybe a good portion of our audience is unaware of that part of the structure of WPR. They may think that it's just a Madison thing. So in those 5 months since you decided to make it official, what have been your thoughts looking back on 35 years? Do you have a proudest moment?
To me, it's a moment that demonstrates the impact. It was that event that we did at RCU the Confluence project became introduced. The committee was going to reveal the results of their studies about facilities in western Wisconsin. They connected with me and said, what do you think about the idea of broadcasting these live? And so I asked you, is that something you'd be interested in? Because it was relating to the arts, I thought it made a lot of sense that you would do that. And we ended up having this event. The panelists were Mike Rindo from UW-Eau Claire Facilities, assistant to the chancellor, Ben Richgruber, who at the time was running the Eau Claire Regional Arts Council, and Linda John from Visit Eau Claire. And then you, of course, were the moderator. You walked around in the audience after they made their presentation. It's a two-hour program, and one of the people who was listening to the program was Sean Hartnett from the university, the geography department, and he had been thinking about this. The doors had accidentally locked from the outside, and I happened to be in the hallway listening, and I heard rap, 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 so I opened it up. Well, he came. He had pictures of the confluence, you know, which, of course, was right across the river from the very place we were, and said this would be the perfect place for something like that. A month later, the proposal for what's now become the Pablo Center for the Arts came out. So that was, that gives me goosebumps right now thinking about, had we not been on the radio, would that have happened? Maybe, but I know because we were on the radio, it got a jump start. Mm-hmm. And that's an important aspect to our community that pretty proud of that. That is pretty cool.
That was a very proud moment for me as well. It was such a melting pot, two separate occasions that we broadcast.
Yes, there was a follow-up meeting a couple months later.
But the comments that people made, I think the head table came away from those knowing there was the will and we needed to find the way.
Yeah. I remember Brady Faust was one of the first people you talked to when we went into the audience, and he'd been part of these sorts of conversations for decades. And then you talked to Justin Vernon, of course, who was a newer element of the same kind of thinking, and it was kind of obvious at that point there was a convergence of thinking that was happening.
A confluence.
Yes, I almost went there. I let you do it.
Allow me to do that, yes. Wisconsin Public Radio, in the 35 years you were involved, how did it change? Or has it?
Yeah, a lot. In kind of critical ways, not much. I mean, it's still about in-depth news. It's still about cultural content presented and curated in a way that is useful to a broad amount of people. It's still focused on civil conversations, I think even more so than we used to be. And I think those are real key elements that have stayed the same through the years. The ways we do it have changed. We created the Ideas Network back in 1990, which allowed this greater concept of having issues-based talk shows. Jack Mitchell, who developed that, was kind of scorned for it in public radio circles. Why would you have something playing against the NPR News Magazine's Morning Edition and All Things Considered? It's like, we want to give people a choice. It's turned out to be a great model. People are stealing all sorts of ideas from it, have been now for several years around the public radio nationally. So Jack was a real innovator, and that was a great idea. And then another big thing that's changed is digital. I mean, we've got this terrific content website, WPR.org. Lots and lots of really good stuff on there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I get the newsletters twice a day that give me the updates. There's a lot of good information there. You know, you and I have been in radio long enough to remember if we did something on the air that was really awful, the one saving grace is, well, at least nobody's ever going to hear it again. And if you did something that was really good, it made you sad because, oh, nobody's ever going to hear that again. But now with digital, you can hear it. I mean, it's in archives. We can archive radio content like we used to always be able to do with print content. Now audio content is archived in such a way that researchers 100 years from now could go back and listen to it.
Mm-hmm. I've always marveled at your ability to stay young, looking and feeling, and it must translate to the privilege that you had for so many years of working with young people at the university.
I've been the advisor for the student radio station at UW-Eau Claire now for about 12 years, but I've always believed in working with young people. My first job out of college was sports director at a station in Antigo, Wisconsin, Mark Blasky's hometown. I'll give him a shout out because I know he's listening. Part of what I did there is I went to all the local high schools and I talked to the head of the English department and said, who's a student who's really sharp who could write me a 20-second report on the local sports games and then call it in? We set up a stringer network of 30 different kids who would call in, and then the next morning I'd pull their stuff off the answering machine and we'd put it up on the air as part of the sports report. Of course, the kids were thrilled. Their parents were thrilled. I've always felt that that was an opportunity. I counted about 150 interns that we've had through the years here at Wisconsin Public Radio in Eau Claire. I've heard from so many of those people
just
in this retirement.
Them, yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's so fun to hear some I haven't heard from for a while, but the amazing thing is with social media, Facebook and LinkedIn, you know, a lot of them have reached back and said hello.
Enjoying a rare studio conversation with Dean Kallenbach, who is enjoying retirement after 35 years, steering the Western Wisconsin Regional Office and other regional offices affiliated with Wisconsin Public Radio. How about a vision? We've looked back. How about a vision? What could we do better and what are we going to have to do?
Yeah. You know, one thing that's changed since I started is the concept of the news desert has become more and more obvious in really the northwestern two-thirds of Wisconsin. There are several counties that have no access to a daily newspaper other than online, and several counties, even their weekly newspaper has been shrinking or has been consolidated. This is not to hammer newspapers. It's a tough time to be in the newspaper business right now. And as public broadcasters, what can we do to help fill those gaps? We'll never be able to do what newspapers do, but what can we do to cover issues that are local in a way that will at least help the community to make decisions about their democracy? Strengthening regional programming is going to be important, but strengthening our capital reporting so that people in Wisconsin know what's going on in Wisconsin. I grew up in Barron County. Your TV options were whatever you could pick up on your antenna. If people had their antennas pointed to the south, the only station they could pick up was Channel 13 because that was really the only station in the region. Channel 8 was too far away, Channel 8 in La Crosse. But if you pointed toward the Twin Cities, you could get four networks. So everybody pointed their antennas toward the Twin Cities. That always bothered me growing up, and I thought, gee, if there is some way we can get, you know, Wisconsinites to pay attention to what's going on at their own capital, they're going to be better citizens. And that was one of the real thrills in me taking the job originally 35 years ago, that's exactly what we got to do, and it's what I've continued to be able to do. Not directly, I'm not the one reporting, but I'm supporting the organization that's providing that reporting, and that's been satisfying.
At the beginnings of our careers, we've both worked small town radio, and that is basically what Wisconsin Public Radio is, can, and should be on kind of a statewide level.
Right, right. Nobody else is doing it like we are. You know, when I started, I think we had 11 stations. We now have 37 stations. And again, you can listen online. You know, you can listen to WPR.org and listen to both of our networks. You don't get all the local stuff. That's another thing I'd like to see us improve on. All the content of Wisconsin Public Radio, including the regional content, be available live online, but all of our stuff is available in archive form, at least within an hour of your show airing. You can hear it online, and the same has been true for the West Side, the show that I've been a part of. We just have to stay true to that vision of giving people something they can count on as being curated without being influenced. Part of our big challenge, I think, in the coming decade or two is educating folks. You want to hear from multiple sides. You don't want to go in with such a heavily formed opinion that you'll only listen to people who agree with you because you think other people are the enemy. And the way democracy works is, yeah, I know where I stand on the issue, but I at least understand why you stand on the issue the way you do. I might not agree with it, but I at least understand what the rationale is. And that's what we can provide. Think about this. Democracy relies on multiple opinions being understood and heard and, you know, finding some compromise once in a while to get stuff done.
You should write a book. That's got to be in the back of your mind.
The Al Ross chapter is about this thick.
His fingers were about an eighth of an inch apart, folks. This is radio. You have to understand that. So any parting words?
One of the beauties of retiring from a place like this is I get to hear a lot of my friends on the radio. It's such an important thing, you know, that we absorb media that is useful to our lives. And it's fun to absorb media that's also important to our lives from a cultural standpoint. It's one of the reasons I think Spectrum West has been such an enduring program. And of course, you've taken it to new levels of production and interview style and skill. I remember a couple of years ago when you won the award for the best interview for the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association. It's one you did with Nobuyoshi Yasuda, and you opened up talking about toilets. There was more, obviously, to the conversation than toilets. But, you know, it's not just some sort of a cookie-cutter interview style that we talk to people because they're people. Humans have stories to tell, and that's a pretty hard thing to replicate.
And we'll continue doing that.
Good deal.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Keep in touch.
I will.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio, where support for WPR comes from Charter Bank, offering fixed-rate mortgages, bridge loans, construction loans, and more. Loan officers Dawn and Susie are dedicated to providing personalized service. Charterbank.bank, invested in partnerships. Support also comes from Hooper Corporation, supplying custom construction services, including electric power, mechanical, and green technology to commercial, industrial, and utility customers nationwide. Hooper Corporation, a Wisconsin company since 1913. National Poetry Month should feature poets, don't you think? We listened to Max Garland last week. Next week, we close the special month with two wordsmiths, one named Smith, as in Thomas R., and Karen Loeb, a former Eau Claire writer-in-residence. This week, it's Bruce Taylor, who's had several titles of distinction over the years, is an emeritus UWEC educator, and who writes in a style that reflects and defines the person in personality. We spoke, we're within a day of the same day we spoke a year ago. We spoke on April 23rd of last year, and this year it's April 22nd. Wow.
Think of what's happened since.
Yeah, let's go back. April of 2020, we were still wide-eyed about what was going on.
Yes.
We had not seen a pandemic since polio way back when. So I'm going to give you a minute to compile the list. What do you know now that you didn't know a year ago?
About anything?
About everything.
Oh, about everything. Well, I don't know. One of the things I think is important is I can steal a line. I can't quote it directly from Garrison Keillor. One thing that this pandemic has shown us is if you've married the right person, you know, and I have.
Good for you.
We have. This was the test, and so far we've passed it. We're still in the same house. No weapons have been drawn, so that's pretty good.
Well,
so I think I know that. And then I never realized I would miss poetry readings so much, live poetry readings. I've given hundreds of readings in my time, and I've hosted and created dozens more. Mm. And as an audience member, I've attended more than even that, you know? You know, it got a little old for me. But, boy, I miss it. And then the change from that to the virtual reading or the virtual everything, words rise and fall on my hate meter. And virtual right now is really up at the top, you know, is a word I hate. I don't ever want to hear again, you know.
Yeah, I
looked up some stuff. The original meaning even a couple of years ago of virtual in Merriam-Webster, was very close to being something without actually being it, which I think is really cool anyway. Now, the number one definition in Merriam-Webster is existing or occurring on computers or on the Internet.
Oh,
that has taken place.
No.
Taken the place of it.
Get
I got
here.
Some more for you, too. It's in the top 1% of words used in any given day online. And if you search Google, 2,180,000,000 references to it in, you know, 7.4 seconds or something.
We've used the term virtually for years, but the term virtual
You know, that L-Y softens it up.
Yes,
I
it
think.
Does.
And I think they tried that with the A-L, too, because virtue itself means something good, something that's strong, something that's true. And you add the A-L to it, and you get the adjective, and then you add the other L-Y, you get the adverb, and no one pays any attention to adverbs anyway.
You enjoy, Bruce. In fact, you require some poems to be verbal and audible. And I really like the quote that you used in a recent email in which you say, when you write some works, you have, quote unquote, you have no intention of them being trapped on a page.
Absolutely.
Unquote. We can expound on that, but here's kind of a secondary question. Would you agree, though, that some poems do indeed flourish on the page and are tailored for quiet consumption and interpretation? That ability seems like such an art to me.
Yes, and you know, there are some even fewer poems that work absolutely on both sides just as well, you know, out loud or on the page. They're very rare, but there are some out there. Just like the difference between music as we understand it, and songs. And once you took the music away from poetry, the live performance away from poetry, it became a whole different thing.
Because
you can lock it on the page, you can stop, you can pause, you can think, well, I don't know what the hell that means. You know, you can read a line again, you can go back and read the whole thing again. It's just a different experience. But when you're doing it out loud and someone's perceiving it out loud, it just happens. It hits them right then and there. So it's different techniques, I think, you have to use to grab people.
We're on the phone with Bruce Taylor, educator emeritus, former Eau Claire City of Poet Laureate. He's a thinker who, if there was a mountaintop around, he'd be sitting up there at the information desk, at least part-time. and we're talking about poetry, as we should, during April, which is National Poetry Month. Poets usually respond to the occurrence of deep stuff. And, you know, the last year could be certainly categorized as deep stuff. Have you done a lot of writing this past year?
Yeah, I always do, but perhaps not as much as some other folks. I've noticed an absolute plethora of COVID anthologies and collections and readings. I don't know that an event like this has happened in our lifetime, anything this large. So lots of people are writing about it, and I've committed my share about that. I write all the time anyway, and I never know what I'm going to write about till I sit down and something happens.
We're talking with Bruce Taylor. You wrote a series about live readings. We sure would appreciate you sharing some of that with us.
Okay. I'm going to read the first poem from this live reading set, and then the last poem.
Wonderful.
The first one's called The Test. This is only a test. If real poetry conditions were prevailing, you'd be instructed to open the Norton Anthology or any old issue of The New Yorker. If a real poetry event were threatening, I would be speaking right now how last night or a week ago, I stepped out my back door, looked out my window, walked in the park, took the car in for an oil change, went to the grocery store, or got laid, and felt something, oh, sort of religious. But this is only a test. If this were a real poem, my father would ignore it, my mother hate it, my sister envy how I got to leave home to write it, and she didn't. Neighbors would snicker, students yawn some more, the parrots squawk, old lovers fume, my wife sigh, my children cringe, but my dog would understand and forgive. A proper poem I'd be reading in my best NPR voice and pausing often and much longer than necessary. And at the end of each line, my voice would quaver sincerely just where I planned it to. And at the end of each line, it would always rise. That's how you know it's poetry. This poem of mine would rhyme all the time. The words ring and chime, bump and grind, alliterate to titillate, totally in awe. All the assonance would always be awesome. It'd be chock full of similes, like a fat bag of skinny cats, like a pocket full of pockets. This poem would be one intricate analogy, a fox in a forest fire, or shit through a goose. A reservoir of memory, a well of wishes deep and cool, a wash of memory, but this right here, is only a test. The brain forecasted then at least a shower, a drizzle, or just a drip, drip. The whole poem, it seems, would be one musical analogy. Admit it, when you stop to think about lots of life is really more the same as lots of other things than you imagined. The eye is, after all, the horizon. The hand, touch and tool. First spear, then missile. The span of many steps to cross. The distance we must go, the ear, sound, and the seeker of sound and silence, which is the voice longing in the darkness to speak. But this right here, this is only a test. So that's the one I usually start with. I love the hamminess of it, you know, where you talk about the things you're not supposed to do and then do them.
Yeah, right.
That has always appealed to me, in more than poetry, too.
And now the last one in a series about live readings.
So it's called, just pertinently enough, The Last Poem. This is, as I mentioned two poems before, the last poem I will read this evening. I gave you the traditional two poems from the end warning, so you wouldn't think this was going to go on all night. So you could find your purse, struggle into your coat, shake the sleep from your legs, unstick your ass from the chair, and go home to your spouse, who wouldn't come with you, you don't blame them. Or maybe first run that errand you have to. Pick up some milk from the store, had to get bread too. Pick up your kids from their lessons or the mall, or just sit in the car a while with that last cigarette you get between here and there. Or stop at the bar for a quick one, maybe stay longer than you planned. Then once more, walk the long way home alone along the fitful river. It's not that I couldn't, if I wanted to, read yet another poem I've written about my life, my wife, my girlfriend, if I had one, my kids, ingrates, my mother, who loved me cruelly, my father, who never said he did, my sister, who shuns me, my aching back and the load it carries, all the loves I've lost or maybe threw away, all those to whom I was unusually cruel. I could have read the poem about how I can't write poetry anymore, or the one that wonders why. I could have dug out those old poems buried in the back of my skull, or the one in the cup of my hand that I offer to the birds, or found the ones in the dark under the bed. Instead, I choose to read my new poem called The Last Poem, because you never know, do you?
Poetry as only Bruce Taylor can write it and recite it. Good stuff.
With the virtual thing, I got to be me. I got to be there. I got to be. I need all the help I can get in those situations.
Bruce Taylor, always a pleasure, man. Thank you so much. And, to poets, you have to say, happy National Poetry Month.
Why, thank you. And I certainly appreciate it. Since I retired and the dog died, very few people will listen to me for this long. So thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Well, 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 that's it for this week. Coming up next week, Creative Economy Month, Eau Claire style, with a very special guest. The 20th Spring Art Tour from Earth Arts in the St. Croix Valley. Poets Times 2, and more. If you've a mind to, share your notions about things and people you'd like to hear. Keep in touch via email, spectrumwest@wpr.org. For now, thanks to Kate and Tommy. Thanks to our guests, past, present, and future. Thank you, mostly, for making time for us. Visit WPR.org to find past programs. Be good to yourself, and by doing that, you'll be good to one another. I'm Al Ross. Bye.